This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
Let's take the opportunity to touch base with Dr. Eleanor Moore. Dr. Moore, good morning to you. Welcome to Power Zone. Mm-hmm.
Good morning, although it feels like the nighttime. So good evening. I apologize in advance if I sound sleepy. This is quite a late night call.
You're sounding just great. Okay. We are enjoying downpours here in Johannesburg, in Gauteng. I'm not sure what's the situation like in the mother city. Are you having any storms, Cape of storms?
Well, I've actually literally just landed from a flight from Johannesburg. So I was there for the last 3 or 4 days.
Okay.
And I only got in an hour ago. I got the last flight of the day. And I've heard that there's no storms, but there's definitely load shedding.
That's unfortunate. Dr. Moore, we can say the President of the Republic will be proud of you, because remember in the first State of the Nation address last year, he came up with the concept Tuma Mina, send me. And recently at the Job Summit, he mentioned the fact that in order to extricate ourselves from this economic quagmire, we need to drive the 24-hour economy. So it's people like you, you know, who are participating around the clock that we appreciate to get the economy going.
You tell my kids that it's 6 a.m. tomorrow morning, or not tomorrow morning, this morning.
Okay. So, you know, this is a very interesting and somehow complex subject, you know. The customary law and the problems it poses for widows, but before we go into the details, if we look at the South African jurisprudence, how can we give a basic definition of customary law for ordinary folk like myself to understand what customary law comprises of?
Sure. Well, I mean, customary law in a textbook says, you know, it means the customs and practices observed among the indigenous African people of South Africa, which form, you know, part of the culture of these people. And it's written in the legislation. There's a working definition of it. But basically, you know, the vast majority of the population live their lives, their personal lives, their family lives, in ways that there's much celebration. There's many rituals, there's many events. Be it marriage, be it, you know, initiation, there's a whole range of events, the passing away and the kind of inheritance that follows us. And these are all marked in particular ways. But more recently, the state has begun to recognize some of these and has gotten involved to make sure there's some form of, I suppose, equality in what is happening. So everybody who's listening, or when I say everybody, the vast majority of people who are listening are living in customary legally orientated ways. And obviously people have a choice to opt in or opt out. They're not bound by it. But most of, you know, the vast majority of people will go through some customary law issues throughout their life, you know. And this is why it's actually a hugely understudied topic in South Africa at the moment, and well, across the world, but in South Africa in particular. So whilst we may be gathering some evidence and knowledge, well, I have to differentiate between the kind of empirical evidence and scientific evidence and the everyday knowledge and the, you know, experiential knowledge that people have in their lives. So the former we're lacking, you know, and the courts are struggling with that, basically.
My approach in this conversation, Dr. Moore, is just to try and set the scene so that there can be an understanding of how the legal system works. Because we know in the South African context, we have this hybrid model, you know, where we've got things from Roman Dutch law, we've got this customary law based on, you know, the African indigenous knowledge and something like that. So in terms of this hybrid model, are there no contradictions in terms of, particularly in terms of the customary law, which is informed by the African indigenous principles and Roman Dutch law? Are there no contradictions to complicate?
There's lots of contradictions.
Okay.
There's lots of contradictions. And I should actually have started off by saying, when we talk about customary law, there are different ways of understanding it. I know I gave some definition there. But what's important is, particularly legal scholars and socio-legal scholars like myself, is that we adopt a living customary law understanding of customary law. That means we recognize that customary law is, you know, what's practiced by the people on the ground. It's not what's written in textbooks. It's not what's codified in jurisprudence or in case law from 1960. It's diverse. It's not static. It evolves. And so I should have actually said that from the outset. So it changes. It changes with times. It changes over generations. And new phenomena can enter it. So things like the use of cell phones or the familiarity with going to the maintenance course can become a form of the kind of acceptable thing to do in a particular instance, do you know?
Mm.
So that's important to say from the beginning. In relation to your question about the tensions, yes, South Africa has a legal pluralistic, you know, system. That means it recognises different forms of law, included in those are things like customary law, religious law, common law, and statutory, like legislation, basically.
Mm.
But they're all working together in parallel, but most importantly, under the umbrella of the Constitution. So nothing overrides the Constitution. The Constitution is the overarching document and framework and approach that, you know, the legal system adopts when trying to understand these contradictions. I can give you multiple examples of contradictions that exist,
mm-hmm.
If you would like. I'll give you one, for example. Well, up to recently, you know, you might have had particularly a codified customary legal principle called male primogeniture, when it comes to inheritance specifically, where the understanding might have been in many instances that the eldest male inherits. And if there's no eldest male in the family, then, you know, the father would inherit, for example. And then pass on to grandchildren, depending on the circumstances of the family. Well, this more recently, in a leading case in 2005, was seen to be unequal in terms of its infringing upon the right of equality and human dignity, because it hinders women's access to inheriting property. But in this, there are complications, deep complications. In particular, the notion of family property becomes problematic. Because, and, you know, please intervene or interrupt or ask me, you know, questions along the way. What the problem is that in customary law and there is different ways of governing kind of rights. Not all rights are seen as individual rights. Many of the property rights are actually communal. Mm-hmm. And things like family property, as you might know and you probably do know, is it's held for the family. One person may be the custodian, let's say the eldest son in a particular example. But together with this kind of family property comes responsibilities of maintaining that property, making that property available for anyone who needs to use it. But the way in which inheritance law, you know, customary inheritance law was redesigned in statutory law didn't take this concept into consideration. And that's deeply problematic.
Mm.
Because we know that property can be, yes, individual, you know, personal property like my belongings, my laptop, my whatever, you know, but it also, and it can also be my house that I bought last week, but we also have forms of property that are familial, that go across generations. No one really owns it, the family owns it, and it's there for all to use. And that type of concept didn't get grasped. The same happened in the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act.
Mm-hmm.
It brought in concepts like in community of property, even into polygamous marriages. Now, it's very difficult to understand how a polygamous marriage can be in community of property when there's multiple players.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in these situations, the legislator kind of, you know, quickly jumps at the opportunity to amend legislation to incorporate customary law, but it doesn't dig deeper into the principles that are in operation in customary law and actually address them in legislation. So it leads to all sorts of complications, which then over time will come to the courts. You know, they don't always appear straight away. We can see the flaws as it's written in the legislation, but it will take time before, you know, there are actual disputes about that that come to the courts.
Okay. I'm in conversation here with Dr. Eleanor Moore, Associate Professor, Department of Sociology at the University of Cape Town. You're listening to Power Zone on Power 98.7. We are unpacking the complexities of the customary law and the problems it poses for widows. We haven't got yet to the part of widows. I know we're just painting a bigger picture, but we will zero in into the specifics. But Dr. Moore, I want us to explain, because, you know, at times there are these perceptions, they might be right, they might be wrong, in terms of the customary law, whether it enjoys the same legal status with any other laws in terms of process. Take, for instance, matters that involve customary law, can they can they go through the entire legal system from your lower courts to the high courts to the appeal court right up to the constitutional court like any other law?
Well, it can, and it does. And it often depends on the kind of the courage and the wherewithal of the judiciary, because they're the ones that can prioritize it. And they're meant to, according to the Constitution. They're meant to, when I say prioritize, they're meant to adopt it, approach it, use it. And we see this in many cases. Justice Musonekwa was a leading example of this. And several, even in cases such as road accident fund cases, which I've just analysed over 300 of those cases. And we see that customary kind of obligations to support kin are being recognised by the judiciary, and customary law is being used instead of common law approaches in those cases. Now, I can go into the detail in those cases, but by all means, customary law in the court is being prioritised. The problem, I think, is rests more so in the design of legislation that is meant to adopt, you know, to reform customary law to be to have more, you know, more clear principles of equality, particularly for gender equality. But they don't always get that right. But in the courts, we have many leading cases. The one I mentioned earlier on, which eradicated, you know, the male primogeniture, was Bear versus Kalicha. And there you'll see a detailed analysis of how customary law, whilst recognising, you know, its position, there was a clash in its in the practice of male primogeniture and the importance of recognising equality, the right to equality for women in particular, and the principles of human dignity when it came to inheriting property. So once there is that clash, then it's obviously the judiciary and often the constitutional courts, you know, is in a position to thrash that out, basically. But from the lower courts right up to the, you know, to the constitutional court, we see it happening. One important thing to remember is when we talk about, you know, legal systems, we have to think more broadly. It's not just the courts, as we know. We have traditional courts, as you know, but we also have things like family meetings. And many disputes are first heard at a family meeting. Now, obviously, a family meeting doesn't have particular legal standing. It can't, for example, issue a divorce. Only a high court can issue a divorce, for example.
Yes.
But it's the place at which a dispute starts. And from there can be escalated, you know, forward up to maybe traditional court, maybe then onwards to a high court, maybe then onwards again. And so far more investigation needs to happen into family meetings and what's going on there, particularly when it comes to things like domestic violence or even inheritance and inheritance disputes. So we need to think, as I said, when we think of the courts, you know, when we shouldn't just look to the higher courts. We need to look to, the, for example, the Master of the High Court. What are the people at the front desk telling, you know, litigants and people coming in the door about their case? What are the Department of Home Affairs telling a particular person, a woman or a man, who comes in to register their customary marriage? Do they allow for it? Or do they just quickly register their marriage as a civil marriage because it's sometimes easier? Now, we have, you know, we've conducted research on this issue, and the evidence points to kind of concerning practices in the Department of Home Affairs. As an example, I know they're not a legal institution, but they are a kind of an arm of the state that is meant to get involved in registering customary marriages. And they're doing that in what we see as problematic, kind of in problematic ways. So there are many players involved in prioritising customary law, from family meetings to informal kind of, you know, kind of dispute resolution fora, together with other state players.
Yeah.
So it, even attorneys need to be more accustomed and more kind of schooled as such in customary law matters. I've just mentioned I've recently come from Joburg. The whole point of my trip there was to listen to a range of disputes regarding inheritance, and most of the disputes relate to customary law disputes, actually, you know, with regards to family property versus personal property or relations between first wives and second wives. And it's just unclear whether the expertise is often there by many attorneys to kind of move between customary law matters and maybe succession matters or maybe kind of, you know, classic family law matters.
Yeah.
yeah.
No, it's very interesting because you mentioned something that I never thought of, to say that a legal system should not be viewed in a single prism, for instance, of an orthodox or traditional legal system, but things like family meetings, you know, they can become some form of arbitration or arbiters, but unfortunately at times they don't have binding resolutions like courts. And I think it takes us nicely, Dr. Moore, into the conversation of customary marriages, you know, because it's going to lead us to the widows. So in terms of the customary marriage, you know, there are things like, for instance, at times you don't register a customary marriage at the Home Affairs Department. Maybe just two families coming together, agreeing on terms and so on. But when the conflict between the husband and wife starts happening, and probably there are now, you know, possibilities of a divorce happening. So I find it difficult to say, how do we arbitrate? Because normally in other like Western marriages, for instance, there will be like this paper signed at Home Affairs. It even articulates that you're married in community of property or it's an antenuptial marriage. You know, everything is written in black and white. And I think it becomes easy for the court to arbitrate. But in customary marriages, it is just an open field. So how do you manage these complexities, especially when there is this conflict now, which leads to separation within this customary marriage?
Yeah, well, it's a great question in the sense of, I mean, the openness and the, you know, is the beauty of it, I think, in the sense of, yes, there are requirements to register a customary marriage these days post-RCMA. So when I say RCMA, I mean the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act. You are required to do so. However, not doing so doesn't mean your marriage is invalid. And that's one of the most important points here. So for any of the listeners or for any of the people, you know, who might be tuning in, just because they haven't registered their customary marriage doesn't mean that marriage is invalid. So there is a time frame through which you're supposed to register the marriage. But as I said, if you don't register, it doesn't mean it's invalid. Remembering registration is just the documentation, you know, documenting that something happened on a certain day. It doesn't mean that just because you register the marriage, it is a valid marriage. And this is where I think people get kind of confused. It is very helpful in many ways because it's proof that something did happen. And then there can still be a dispute about whether that was an actual marriage. Was it? Do they conclude a customary marriage?
So, Dr. Moore, define registration for us. What will take a legally registered customary marriage? What will it take?
Exactly. So you go to Home Affairs or one of the service points, you know, for Home Affairs, and you go along. And this is the problem. There are, you know, requirements of what you're supposed to bring along with you. And the first thing would be your Lobola letters, for example. But you'd also be expected to bring witnesses. So whoever were the representatives during those negotiations, during maybe the celebrations thereafter, or the transfer of the wife in particular. Mm-hmm. So whoever you can kind of rally around and bring with you, they're technically they're required to come with you, which you can understand is a very expensive and kind of rigorous, you know, or onerous, I should say, kind of expectation to put on someone. Whereas, you know, with a civil marriage, you basically just have to show, you know, that you just need one witness to say that you were married. So when people come to register their customary marriage, they do need Lobola letters. They could bring the traditional leader if the traditional leader was notified about the customary marriage. We know nowadays not all traditional leaders are notified every time there's a customary marriage, but some are, obviously. It still happens. So he or she, the traditional leader, would be another representative or another witness. So you have to bring witnesses and some kind of documentation, which would be Lobola letters, generally speaking. And there you are expected to then document that. So in our research, we found that the vast majority of people, particularly in rural areas, and that we did our research in rural areas across six provinces, very few customary marriages are registered. You know, a small percentage. And most of those people who are registering are probably either living in urban areas or have some kind of connection to urban areas that they frequent an urban area, you know, often. So they're able to access either the information or actually just get to a Home Affairs easily or as part of their daily routine, you know, because when you think about it, for most people, it would cost at least 50 rand to get to an urban area, or maybe 100, depending where you're living. And then, you know, you're expected to go with two or three other people. So you're going to spend maybe 150 rand, 200 rand, depending again where you're living. So that's what we were finding out when we were doing work in a particular area of the Eastern Cape, you know, we were working in. It was literally, you know, 40 kilometers to the next Home Affairs, which wouldn't be unheard of. You know, that could be quite normal for many people. And then you're expected to bring multiple people, and therefore the cost adds up. But also, the other requirement was, it was unclear, and it still is unclear with the Department of Home Affairs, whether both the bride and the groom, or the man and the woman, have to consent to the registration. So at the moment, it stands that both parties have to consent to registration, whereas we would argue that actually one person should be able to register the marriage. Because you can imagine in many situations, I won't say most, but in some situations, you might get a spouse who's unwilling to register for whatever reason, not that there's anything sinister about it, just that they're not familiar with it, they don't want to do it, it costs too much money. So actual registering obviously doesn't cost money, but just getting to Home Affairs, it costs money.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, that was another problem with registration. But the key to registration is not so that we can all document our lives. You know, the key to it is that one, because you asked the question about divorce earlier, one of the main practices we see in the courts and just in everyday life is that when there is a dispute, the first thing that will be disputed was that there was ever a customary marriage in the first place. Because that's easier. It's easier to say there was no customary marriage than to go down the road of divorce.
Yes.
Because divorce is more costly in many ways, you know, and more problematic. Whereas you can just question the validity. You can say, oh, we only partially paid Lebola, which is also fine in many instances, or we just did this, or we just did that, but she was never transferred, or, you know, and that's the real danger.
Yeah.
And that's what happens in the courts often, be it upon inheritance, where the wife is kind of alleged to have never been a wife, or when if it comes to divorce. And they're the real issues.
Indeed. The voice of Dr. Elena Moore, Associate Professor, Department of Sociology at the University of Cape Town. We're focusing on customary law and the complications. Now, coming to registration, when coming to polygamous marriage, so the issue of registration is just is the same, because I know in KZN, for instance, there's one gentleman who married about six women. You know, so the registration process is the same. It doesn't really matter whether you marry one or more than one in terms of customary law.
There is a difference, though, in what you're expected to bring. So that. Polygamous marriage and the numbers of registration for polygamous marriages are even lower, because most people in polygamous marriages aren't registering their marriages.
Oh, okay.
But what you're expected to do is, when a second wife comes along, you are expected to get the consent of the first wife, first of all. And secondly, at that point, the first wife, the marital, so the financial arrangement, so the division of matrimonial property, so whether it's in community of property or not, is reassessed. So the first wife can say, okay, I consent to the second wife coming along, but I'm going to take what's mine. And I'm going to kind of ring fence that, and that's mine forever. And then the second wife can be in community of property with the husband, but she's already kind of, the first wife has gotten what she, now in reality, we know this doesn't happen. Mm. You know, people in polygamous marriages don't think like this necessarily either. Some might. But the fact that very few registrations are taking place. So the thing is that the couple or the polygamous, you know, couple or and are supposed to register this arrangement. So the new financial arrangement of that polygamous marriage.
Yes.
And that's not happening. And therefore, when it comes to a dispute from the first wife, the second wife, the husband, whoever, it's unclear who's going to get what.
Now let's get to the real issues of customary marriage. And by the way, guys, feel free to get in touch if you want to weigh in into the conversation on 0861 987 000, or you can get in touch at PowerFM987, hashtag PowerZone, or on my Twitter handle at Murillo Muriano. I'm in conversation here with Dr. Elena Moore, Associate Professor, Department of Sociology at the University of Cape Town in the Mother City. Dr. Moore, Now, it's easier to deal with issues of inheritance when there is a divorce, a separation. But I think the complication comes when the spouse, when the husband dies. And people, women who are married in customary law, they are subjected to so many things, especially from the family of the husband. So are there any laws that protect the widows?
Sure. Well, there are. And this is the thing. So there is statutory law. So I mentioned the case earlier, Bev versus Khalichi and Magistrate, and some other cases. And basically, these are the leading cases that were to protect women, whether women were daughters, whether women were wives, you know, or in particular daughters and wives, and whether they were married daughters or unmarried daughters. So that particular case in 2005 led to a major change in the legislation. And that change in legislation was called the Reform of Customary Law of Succession and Regulation of Related Matters Act of 2009. And basically what it did is that it brought into line a series it's basically now subject to the Interstate Succession Act. So it's now kind of what in line with civil law when it comes to inheritance. So, for example, there are rules about who inherits what when, let's say, one spouse dies and there's no children, or if one spouse dies and there are children, or if there's one spouse dies and there's a polygamous marriage. So it maps this all out about exactly who should get what in these instances. Now, the most important thing to remember here as well is that, remember, if a wife is left, like if the husband passes away, the spouse, the wife, first of all, receives 50% of the marital assets, and then she inherits, because she's already in most, so all customary marriages, when you enter into them, are in community of property automatically, unless you say otherwise. So unless you bring an antenuptial contract into the marriage, which, again, most people don't do. Okay. Most people don't even know that that's available.
What if there is a will within the customary marriage?
Yeah, no, wills can be made.
Work out. Okay.
Wills can be made. The danger is that many wills might be oral. So there might be, a kind of a said thing by a grandmother or by a grandfather that this grandchild should get it. And these are the kind of disputes I was listening to now in Joburg for the last couple of days. Particularly when it's not necessarily family property. So, if it was other property. So when we think of property, we've got to think broadly. You know, it's not just land or houses. It's also livestock. It's also personal belongings. It's also things like taxi businesses, potentially. You know, there's a whole range of types of properties that exist when someone passes away, depending, on the resources, obviously. Yeah. And family property is one thing, but other properties, it's up for grabs, basically. And we see that different people are grabbing onto it. So in the case of a polygamous wife, you might have subsequent wives, kind of saying that the first wife or the second wife wasn't really a customary marriage, a wife, I should say. So they're doubting her position, and therefore they're trying to deny her of her share of the inheritance. But also you get families. The husband's family might say, well, she was never a wife in monogamous marriages.
Yeah.
And therefore, you've got things like property grabbing. It was kind of being documented over the last 2 decades, really, where husbands' families kind of mistreated the customary wife upon the death of their, their son or their brother. And they would kick out, or make it very unbearable for the customary wife.
Yeah.
And particularly for what we call immovable property, for houses. But these days, you've also got policies and pensions. So when it becomes quite tricky when someone is first up to that employer to say, I'm the wife.
Yeah.
And whoever gets there first, I mean, it's not whoever gets there first, but employers aren't great at recognizing the complexities of customary marriages and doing their homework to see, well, actually, is there another wife here?
Yeah.
Or is there someone else here? So I've just listened to a couple of cases where, the second wife got to the employer first and she got the policies And these are substantial. These are payouts of, you know, let's say 5,000 rand per month for the rest of her life. So this is like this is a regular income. And pensions are the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's in these cases, it's disputes often between women, actually. It can be between wives and, you know, the sisters of the deceased or the mothers of the deceased. So it's not just a gendered issue often. Mm. This now happens to kind of cross, you know, what would be lineage, I suppose, but there's a hierarchy that mothers and sisters of the deceased might have more power, depending on the individual, you know, the circumstances of the family.
Yeah, maybe I need to do a will.
Everyone needs to go
to avoid all, to cause people headaches and unnecessary headaches.
Yeah, I know. But we don't, you know, do we have to go down that road of contracting our lives away? It's difficult.
Difficult. So, Dr. Mo, you mentioned the case of 2003, 2005, but there was a high-profile case in 2018 involving a superstar, a WHP.
Sure, yeah.
And the judgment of that particular case divided the nation. Social media, talk show programs, and so on, including here on Power 98.7. Because what Judge Ratamo Kwatleng ruled in that case, it was, I think for so many people, it was complex. People didn't even understand the judgment. Is there any way you can simplify it for us? Because remember, there were two issues. Firstly, the wife wanted to retain the body because she declared herself the legitimate wife. And then the family of WHP at the time, they were saying, no. The marriage, you separated from our son. You moved out of the house for months. And by the way, we didn't even complete the lobola processes. And earlier, you mentioned the issue of cell phones and videos and stuff, you know, and they were brought in as part of evidence. And I was saying, in customary law, you've got these videos and cell phones and so on coming in. Can you just simplify for us the context of that judgment before we go to Nkosan and Vanderbilt Park wants to ask a question as well?
Sure. The first thing I have to say, this judgment was done very quickly. And some of my colleagues, you know, in the law faculty in particular, are quite skeptical about the level of investigation that would have been required to get into grips with a case of this matter.
Yeah.
So in this matter, as you've rightfully pointed out, there was a contestation whether she was actually a customary wife, and this happens a lot, as I've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, then the issue is whether she could retain the body or not. Subsequent, you know, once the issue of whether she was a wife would be kind of resolved, there's no way a judgment and a hearing could take place so quickly following the death of WHP. You know, it was literally days, and it was, I can't remember the exact timing of the whole issue, but it was a very quick event.
It was predetermined.
It had to be. You know, it had to be. That was the whole, you know, the whole point of it. So with all due respect to the court, and actually the judgment hasn't, at the time I was investigating this and we were all, reading about it, the judgment hadn't been released, although it had been aired and people were showing it on YouTube and things like that. But basically, I would argue that it was almost impossible for the judiciary and for the various legal teams to gather the evidence to say that this was, you know, to question the validity of the marriage in the first place. And secondly, there was the son of WHP who got evicted from the house, supposedly or allegedly evicted from the house. And the question of who that son was and whether he was part of the, you know, it was very unclear. And it wasn't alluded to in the hearing and as I said, there wasn't a judgment available at the time that I was reading about this. So I am slow to comment on this case, although, you know, we can use it as a kind of platform to talk about the issues. We need to wait for that judgment to get all the facts. The facts in that case are not yet clear. And I know what facts in customary law cases are not always clear, and there's two sides. But in this instance, I think it's quite critical because the validity of the marriage is being questioned.
Yeah.
And therefore, we need to know more. And I didn't hear about this. We need to know more about the Lobola negotiations, what exactly was negotiated, and secondly, about the process of the transfer of the wife to his family.
Yeah.
And that wasn't detailed from what I read. I mean, and I didn't have access to the judgment at the time because it wasn't available. It should be available now, actually. I should get a hold of it again.
Maybe that's the reason why it caused so much division in the country. Yeah, okay.
But the problem is with this division is that we were all talking about, not hearsay, but about inconclusive kind of evidence. Do you know that kind of way? And that doesn't help.
Exactly.
Because there were no facts even outlined by the court.
Yeah, people said Judge Ratamokhwatle used the wisdom of Solomon to satisfy both parties. Let's go to Fanar Belpak and welcome Nkosana. Nkosana, good morning to you. Welcome.
Yeah, good evening. Good morning, sir. Yeah, you're speaking to Nkosana. I'm in Fanaville Valley. So, Mr. Mrio, I have a problem. My father passed away in 2004. So he was married to another wife. He divorced with my mother, my father. Then he married another wife. He has two children, which are twins. Then all of us, we are six. So now, when we supposed to get our father inheritance, we found out that my father has signed with the woman. So now, then they didn't want us to have any part of his inheritance. So the case, I've been running this case since 2004 till last year, and even now I'm still to struggle with the lawyers. I try everything with the legal aid, I fail. I try some of the other stuff. I make it my own. So I managed to get the evaluation because my father has a two property of houses and one stand. So now I managed to, through the court, through, because I was still listening to Power. Normally you talk about these things, then I try to do these things on my own.
Okay.
I go to the court. They give me other letters so that I can get the evaluation of the house and the deeds. I only stuck there. Then for furthermore, I couldn't, because they sent the other papers to the Master 5 court so that we can be called, all of us, for a round table. So now I'm still waiting for the calling letter. Nothing happens. I'm still struggling. And which is, they say it will be 14 years.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm still struggling with the lawyers. I'm not working. I'm struggling.
Yeah. Okay, Nkosana, let's hear what Dr. Moore has to advise on this one. Dr. Moore?
Okay, sir.
Okay, well, just so you know, I'm not actually a lawyer, so I'm supposed to give legal advice. If I've understood your case correctly, you said your father passed away, and but before he did that, he had signed with another woman. Did he remarry?
Yes.
Did he marry another woman?
Yes. He married another woman.
And
then the other woman had two kids. Yeah. And then everything was signed with the second woman. So basically, maybe they married it in community of property.
Property, so, and she got everything.
Yeah. And then she inherited everything.
Okay. And was that a customary marriage or was that a civil marriage?
Do you know, Gosana, if it was a civil marriage or a customary marriage? Do you know that?
Yeah, according to the way, because they were not doing the proper wedding, like a white wedding and so forth. They only sign and they have a party, just like that.
Yeah.
I went to the Home Affairs. I only found out that they were married. With my mother, it was a customary marriage. But in my father's place, they know my father married. But when I go to make my own investigation, I found out my father is, it's single, but it was my mother secretively. I don't know if that said. Yeah. Now my mother, she said I must pursue this and fight for her. And now my father sell other house in Sibukeng. He then go and marry another woman. Now he passed away. He's no longer here.
So the father's passed away, and now the second wife is the one who's currently, who's currently in charge of the properties, the stand of the one property.
Yes, and now the other thing, Mr. Mugyo, the woman make an authority letter. Everything that we touch is just need her. Now, I just fighting for this authority so that all of us, as we are for at the other marriage, so that we can have something and the property as well. Now we are staying at my father's house, and you know the situation in the kitchen. Now I can't just like staying with my granny's home. We are too many.
So Nkosana, final question.
I should just ask. Okay. Did he have a will, or was this interstate? Did he have a will, or did he not have a will?
I'm not too sure, but according to the way when I go to the court, the guy said we have a 25%. Now he's just he can't just help us. I don't know, but I'm struggling. I don't know what to do now because it's almost 14 years now. I'm still running with this case.
So Nkosana, tell me, you mentioned something that in your last interaction with the court, they mentioned that they will convene a meeting to solve the particular issue. Have they indicated when are they going to convene that particular meeting, or I didn't hear you correctly?
When I go to the court, they send letters to the Bloemfontein, because my father was staying in Bloemfontein in Sasolburg. Because of the demarcation, I pushed my case in this side of Vanderbijl.
Yeah.
Now, when I went to the Bloemfontein, I just make an appeal to be against the authority letter, so that I can make sure that we are still alive and we are available. So now they said we must wait for the cooling letter. Now we're still waiting. I don't know. There's nothing moving. Now I don't know to this system. How does it go? It's tricky now. I don't know. It's the tactics of so that I can give up this case.
No, you mustn't give up. Yeah, Dr. Mo, if you have any other thing.
The presence of a will is important here. So if he had a will and he allocated, the house, or I don't know if it's the two properties or the one property, but the stand and the two properties to his wife, well, then that could have been his intention. Yeah. If there was no will, then I think, Kasana, you probably have quite a strong case, because the spouse will inherit something, but children are equally are meant to inherit as well. So a spouse wouldn't be able, if there was no will, a spouse wouldn't get everything, put it that way, or her children. It'd be all children equally. Regardless of whether they were of the marriage or not of that marriage.
For disturbing. The other thing, like when you go to the company, they give us the info about where the pension fund was laid. Now I find out my name is on top. And it's written Mrs. Nkosana Kaba, 1960. So this is where I proceed and I challenge the company. When I challenge the company, they give me the letter at the court so that I can give it to the company. Now they emailed the court, the estate court. Now that they give it the other number so that it's calling the Covey Holdings. So now they said we have a percentage of 25%. I don't know.
Nkosana, from what you're telling me and Dr. Moore here, you have done so much, and you are just about to conclude. You must not lose hope. I think that the next thing you must is to go back to the court and say, we want that date. Give us the date, because you have done so much, and it is quite clear that you are entitled in terms of the pension funds, in terms of so many things. So don't lose hope. The wheels of justice at times, they grind very, very slowly. So I will encourage you that your final step will have to go back to the court and say, I was here on this date. You promised that you're going to convene a meeting so that we could close this particular issue. Definitely, man, you mustn't give up. I think you have done so much.
Yeah, Mr. Mugo, the other thing that let me down is the guy said where I go to that court in Vanderbijl, I'm staying in Bipatone. The guy told me that I must go to the Bloemfontein so that I can get the calling letter for myself, so that I can issue to my stepmother. The thing, I don't know why the court mustn't do that thing, because we are not in a good relationship with that woman. Now they put my life on the line, because maybe I don't know what's going to happen. You know, these things of the estate. Now she found out in the last day, she sent people here at my place, to my granny's place. They were coming with their car. Now I go and I tell the court that I fear for my life now, because I think that maybe they thought maybe I'm just trying to dig up the corruption that they did there on my papers, because they manipulated the system. Because I went there and I said, I want my father before, my father wrote in the stuff, and after the funeral. So now they send people with cars here. Now I go ahead, then I challenge the court. I tell them that I'm scared for my life now. Because they said I'm digging certain stuff now.
Yeah. Wow. It's a challenging one. So tell me finally, what did the legal aid say?
They said I'm over age. They can't help me.
Jesus. Now,
yeah, they said they can't do anything for me. I try, Mr. Muria, even go to Joburg, up and up, even Mr. Falcott there. I normally go there. Even Bloemfontein, there was this guy, Paul. So, like I said, I just push certain stuff of my own. I try different courts, Mr. Muria, because I didn't have a faith with the court, because I thought maybe there's something going on. And the only person that did everything is that the guy from Sasolbeck, that he resigned. Yeah, I'm about to lodge a complaint about him. Maybe there are my allegations, but they were true, because if I tested, because that guy, I went to my stepmother to find out about my father. After the funeral 2005, we went to the funeral, to the court. We only found out by then my father's asset was 850,000. After that, she went alone.
Yeah.
Then everything suddenly changed. Maybe the guy told him that, no, you shouldn't come with this child here. It's your child or what? Now she taught me up. Then when time goes on, then we get certain stuff like this.
Yeah. Well, let's hope, because people don't sleep. If there's any lawyer who's listening at the moment, they will get in touch with us. And maybe we will also explore to check if there is a legal ombudsman or something, you know. I'm not sure if we have, because I know that in every government department, you find that there is an ombudsman where you can register your complaint on that. But Nkosana, the best of luck. I will also do a bit of research in terms of whether there is any legal ombudsman that you can contact, because it's been a very long time. 14 years, it's a long time.
This year will be 14 years, Mr. Murray.
It's a long time. The best of luck. We'll try and find out. Well, because the only solution I can think of at this point in time is maybe if we can get a legal ombudsman, because if legal aid has mentioned that you're over age, it doesn't make sense to me. Anyway, the best of luck, Nkosana, there from Funeral Bill Park. Dr. Moore, these are some of the challenges that are existing, and you can imagine how many people there are. But before you comment further, Jerry has been holding for quite a while in Letlhabile. Okay. Jerry, good morning to you. Welcome.
Hi, Jerry. Hey, how are you?
Fine, how are you, sir?
Yes, you will actually accept my apologies, or I've forgotten some of the stuff that I wanted to talk about. I just want to pass my greetings to Dr. Dorothy Moore.
Elena Moore.
Yeah, Dorothy Moore.
Well, thinking of the musician, Dorothy Moore.
Call me Angel of the Morning. Actually, Dr. Moore must sing the song for us. Just call me Angel of the Morning before you leave. Yeah, and my brother, I just want to interpret this matter in this way, né? The issue of the customary marriage, because remember that according to the law of the Republic, customary and law was actually derived or actually taken from African indigenous law. Now, the main issue here is the issue of interpretation of the very same customary law. Let me take you to Britain for a bit. Britain, you have a monarch there, which is the queen. And customary law is actually being applied effectively and without any hesitation and without any stumbling blocks. Now, you come back to South Africa, you go to our court, for instance, you find that the judges and the lawyers, the prosecutors there, they are from an Afrikaner background. They are actually from the Dutch system, but they don't interpret even the Dutch system accordingly because of their Afrikaners. Remember, there is a slight difference between Afrikaners and Dutch. Now, we are using a hybrid system in the country. Check what is happening in terms of interpreting the very same customary law. Let me give you an example about the case of the case law of Dalinyebo. You remember what happened with Dalinyebo, the king of in the guy was actually sentenced not mitigating the customary law. You go to KZN and you find many farmsters there, they are still applying customary laws. And you come to South Africa in our courts, you find that lawyers and the judges, they cannot interpret customary laws. Now let's go back to the issue of Chapter 12 of the Constitution, which is traditional leaders. According to the Chapter 12 of the Constitution, traditional leaders are the ones who are actually acting as the umbrella body of customary law in the country. And 3 years back, the Tamarako Tavajan, who was actually representative of the traditional leaders in the parliament, resigned from the parliament, mitigating the issues of outlining the issues.
Jerry? Jerry, are you still with us?
I beg your pardon?
No, we lost you for a bit there. You were still talking about the Tobajan who resigned from parliament, and you got caught a bit.
He said that the parliament is very much ignorant in terms of applying customary laws, and they are not concerned about the issues that are affecting customary laws within the community. You know that we have got the community laws, we've got the legal norms, and those are not well applied. Because why? We cannot have customary laws that can exist in the country whereas we do not have umbrella body, which is should be a contra lesa, which is under the Chapter 12 of the Constitution. Now, the question that I want to ask to the doctor there is that how do you apply customary laws whereas we don't have the body enshrined in the Constitution, which is the Chapter 12 of the Constitution, which is only single page? It is not actually giving the contra lesa the powers to do so. As a result of that, we've got the control level in the parliament that is non-existent. Now, I want to know, my brother, how are we going to apply the customary laws of which you don't have a representative in the parliament? Because the parliament is the one that must promulgate laws, policies, to make sure that they supervise the issue of customary laws in the community. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you, and remember, my brother, in most cases, we find marriages that are ending up in court because we say, before you apply customary marriage or customary law, you must apply your tradition, African tradition. How do you apply customary laws whereas you have African tradition that were actually ignored because we don't have a very existing controller in the parliament that should make sure that customary matters in the community are...
Okay, Jerry. That. Yeah.
Do we really have a controller and the board that is actually supervising the customary law? Because customary law, my brother, cannot be applied by a judge who does not have a knowledge about customary law. That is why we see under Chapter 9, we've got the CRL, which must consist of the people who understand the African indigenous policies and the culture.
Yeah. Jerry, thank you very much. Good question indeed. Dr. Moore, you posed a number of questions.
I make sure I heard it correctly. Well, the final part of the question was, how do you apply customary law when some of the judiciary and the parliament themselves, but particularly the judiciary, don't even live or know that customary law?
Yes.
Is that the last part of the question?
Yeah, that was the last part of the question.
I fundamentally agree with you. You know, it's deeply flawed that we have a judiciary, and it's not just the judiciary, because the judiciary are, you know, made up of attorneys and advocates and people who go through the system, be it from students, from people, you know, people in the society, all the way up to become judges. And they need to know broader print. They're not going to know every single customary practice of every single community in the country. That's just impossible. Nobody can know that. But what they would be expected to know are the broad principles of most customary practices and the customary laws that go with those practices across a range of ethnicities. And more importantly, they should realize the principles of living customary law, that to use precedent and to use, you know, older cases or cases that are in different parts of the country. So they can't basically use the law in the same way that they would do under common law, just citing, you know, cases from 2005 or, you know, from a different part of the country, because that doesn't work when we are looking at cases that are based in particular contexts, you know, particular geographical contexts involving particular groups of society. So I agree with you. You need, many members of the judiciary are well placed to adjudicate on customary law. And whilst they may not be from the exact same region or the exact same locality as the, you know, the litigants coming before them, they definitely have the skills and knowledge to apply But what they are required to do, and this is what they don't necessarily, not all of them do, and some do very well and some don't do at all, is that they should be literally delving into the detail of what's happening on the ground. If that requires actually getting onto the ground, going to that particular site where these litigants are coming from and asking and ascertaining the living customary law of a particular issue, whether it's, you know, it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's customary marriage practice or whatever it is, that's what they should be doing. Mm-hmm. And that's what some judges are beginning to do. That's highly commended, basically. But across the board, that's not what's happening. Yeah. We see a range of malpractices by some judges, and that's deeply problematic. And it's not recognizing customary law for what it is and what its position is in the Constitution. So yeah. It's actually what it is doing is it's recodifying a kind of version of customary law that isn't what's happening on the ground.
Yeah.
So we actually, in our book, we call for a different form of adjudication, one that's far more active, far more engaged with the litigants' real life and the practices that, you know, they are practicing. And that literally does require, and this is why I say some judges are doing it, they are using pieces of evidence, be it cell phones, you know, asking a range of witnesses to come to give evidence about what was happening in that particular dispute, you know, and they're doing that very well. But it's not happening evenly across the board. And you do see some kind of problems occurring.
Yeah,
we saw one recently, but I'll leave it at that for the moment.
No, I think the other issue that Jerry brought about when he was speaking a lot about contra lesa, it's about, you know, that the diversity that we are here in South Africa. And if you look into rural areas like your rural Limpopo, within rural Limpopo, for instance, you've got vendor customs, you've got Sepedi customs, you've got Shangaan customs. You go to Rustenburg, they've got their Tswanak, you know, the customs. And even in Phukeng specifically, you know, the Royal Bafokeng Nations, they've got their own traditional court there. And KZN, obviously, with the rural area. So we are a diverse society with different customs and how we should adjudicate problems. Now, it poses a massive question that in this diverse society with different customs and traditions, and if we have to adjudicate conflicts under customary law, how do we reconcile the customary law within the jury, within the South African jurisprudence, and what we practice in our own localities? I think that's the contradiction that we started talking about. But, you know, Jerry somehow brought it home to say, you know, with contra lesa, these are traditional leaders in different communities throughout South Africa with different customs. So how do we reconcile the two?
So those tensions are there. I mean, and there are various actors and players who are trying to reconcile it. So, for example, I can give you a leading case, Jazila case. It was the first case of Ukutwala that was brought to the High Court here in the Western Cape. I'm trying to remember the exact year, but it was something like 2014. I should know. But anyway, and the case was a leading case in the sense of it was a form of, as you know, customary marriage based on an abduction where the community actually supported the practice. Now, this particular man was alleged to have beaten, abducted, and raped his, you know, then-to-be wife, who he brought then to Cape Town from the Eastern Cape. And this judgment is available online. You know, you can read it. And basically, it was appealed. He appealed it. So he was convicted of a series of offences, including rape, amongst other things, and you know, and he was sentenced to, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was around 15 to 20 years imprisonment or something like that, you know, like extensive. And he appealed it. And basically he got a series of witnesses from his community or like, you know, people. And what happened was two very good scholars in UWC said, we're going to go back to that community and we're going to see what people thought. And actually what the community said was, we supported that marriage.
Wow.
He didn't do anything wrong. If you're going to imprison him, you have to imprison all of us.
Jeez.
I would recommend, by the way, for your listeners to read this judgment and, you know, subsequent papers that have been written about this.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the judiciary at the time and the court at the time still said that although these practices, it was kind of the apparent form of a Uketwala, where there's been...
By the way, that is forced marriage of young girls by older men, particularly practiced in the Eastern Cape. Yeah.
Sure. I'm not saying this is the way in which Uketwala is practiced by any means.
Yeah.
I'm just giving an example of a case that's fairly recent.
Yes.
Mm. That had this tension where the community supported what he was doing, and it wasn't just him, it's his family, the girl's family, et cetera, et cetera. And yet the court was against it.
Yeah.
In principle, because it questioned her right to consent, it questioned her right to bodily protection and harm, you know, against bodily harm, and a whole range of rights were violated according to the judiciary. Mm. And in particular, when they talked about the customary practice, they felt that this practice, the way in which it was being practiced in this particular instance, was an apparent form of customary practice. It wasn't the way in which Uketwala was, and they say, I won't say traditionally because, you know, that's problematic in itself, but it wasn't one of the acceptable forms of Uketwala. And they listed, you know, three different ways in which Uketwala can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And there was excessive violence, and it inferred on her, on several of her rights, in particular right to consent and to bodily and to harm, basically.
Yeah.
So it's a tragic case in many ways, both for the girl and for the, you know, for the woman and for the man. But it also is a case that shows us of these tensions are real.
Very interesting, and I think it answers the contradictions, you know. Yeah, because the community there, they were saying we support the particular action, it's in line with our practice and customs, but the court view it differently, you know. So this is quite interesting.
I mean, female initiation is another one, you know. Female initiation is ongoing in different parts of Limpopo and different parts of KZN, as you probably know. And actually, the Children's Act has now, in 2006, said children under, is it 14 or 16? I should get this right. Sorry, you can see I'm not a lawyer. But it's either 14 or 16 are not, you know, are not allowed to be initiated. But we know that this practice occurs. And if you actually, and we've done research on this, if you speak to any of the women who've been initiated, they look forward to it. They wanted to do it. It was celebratory. It was part of being, you know, becoming a woman. A whole range of reasons, justifications, understandings of the practice that are, you know, not in line with what the Children's Act actually says. And that's a problem, you know. So basically, the legislation is outlining a particular way to practice our practice, like in female initiation and virginity testing in particular. But that's not how the community see it, and not how the people who govern their own lives see it, both from the elders, but also from the younger girls who are practicing this.
Yeah,
there are many instances like this, I should say.
Exactly. I'm about to wrap up my conversation with Dr. Elena Moore, but before we do that, if you've got any couple of questions or comments you want to make, feel free. We're left with only 7 minutes to conclude our interesting conversation about issues of customary law. Dr. Moore, you know, I think the issue of Nkosana from Funnel Bill Park, it sort of explains the dimension of kids falling victim or being excluded from the inheritance. But I just want to focus, because I could see here, besides being the associate professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Cape Town, you're also the director of the Families and Societies Research Unit at the Center for Social Science Research. In the beginning of the show, I spoke about the vision of former President Nelson Mandela and the fact that he founded the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund. And in terms of their vision statement, they endeavor to change the way society treats its children and the youth. And I was even saying that this morning I was driving through, you know, to Joburg Stadium, passing through the bridges, and you find young kids, young boys in this rain. They are street kids, basically. They are living there. And then I'm saying, what kind of a society are we that we should it should just be normal? It is normal that our kids are street kids. They're sleeping on the streets, they're smoking all sorts of substances. And also to take it into the courts. I know the NGOs like Teddy Bear Clinic, for instance, they were fighting so hard to transform the courts to have like the children's courts. Because we know the level of abuse of kids in this country, be it violent or sexual. And you find that these kids are subjected to what we can call secondary or second victimization when they when they get into these courts, you know. When, yeah, for instance, the perpetrators have been arrested. So in terms of your research, are there any things that can be done to circumvent all these ills that are, you know, that are affecting our kids in this country?
Sure. That's a big question, huh?
I just decided to throw it in as you conclude.
No, it is a big question because, I mean, each social ill or evil is structural, first of all. We have to understand that they're not just children, they're specific children. They're usually children of poorer families, usually families of color, not always, but, you know, often. And it has a particular historical underpinning, you know, where these some of these problems are not about that individual child or that individual family who have supposedly, you know, inverted commas, abandoned that child, for want of a better word. But somehow state services were not there to either support that child or to support that family or both. And we know that poor families and poor children, or children that come from poorer families, are more likely to experience this, you know, disadvantage, not just economic disadvantage, but all the other disadvantages that come when there's inadequate resources to support families. And homelessness is a good example. So actually, I supervise a postgraduate student who's doing work on this. And when she looked at the policies of what do we do with some particularly homeless children, you know, but not just children, the kind of transition into, from children into kind of more adults, you know, so when they get to the late teens. And the first, one of the first replies by the state is reunification, reunification with the family. But that doesn't necessarily recognize that the family might have been the problem in the first place. So I think we have to forget, we have to start, and the state is to blame in many of these instances, pathologizing families and individuals to say that they're the problem. They've got no, you know, solidarity amongst them. They're a weak family. They're a bad family. It's like what people do to when there's abandoned babies. You know, they start to blame mothers.
Yeah.
Poor mothers, reckless mothers, you know. It's not the mothers. It's not the problem. It's the fact that there's no support for that mother. Either be it through education, about knowing what her options might be it adoption, you know, be it contraception or whatever. But again, if the state isn't clued up on what the key problems are of why that particular child is homeless, so why that particular family either couldn't support that child or why that child couldn't remain in that family for because of abuse or for whatever other reason, then reunification, for example, if it was one of their key responses, isn't going to help. Because putting the child back into a dangerous family. So the state has to recognize that all not all families are sites of harmony. That there are families are, you know, there's high levels of conflict in many families. We know that. So talking about, and you know, if you look at the white paper from the government, you know, the state's white paper, it's talking all about strong families. This kind of glossy term about what we should be doing. We should be strengthening family solidarity. Well, that's true. We could be if we actually put some resources into it and help families do so. And just giving cash and social grants, whilst it's doing a lot, it's alleviating a lot of poverty, it's not enough. Cash is never enough.
Yeah.
You need support services. You need care. So, for example, the most recent phenomenon happening in the country is the proposal that adoption services would be all now state-led, that the private industry in adoption would be cut out, so that social workers would be now running every single adoption. And that's just ludicrous. Social workers are already overburdened. We know this.
Yes.
Mm. So to add another, you know, range.
And they don't even employ more. That's the sad reality in this country.
Exactly. Yeah. So how are they going to manage with a huge caseload of adoptions? It's just not possible.
Yeah.
And what is that going to mean? It means children are going to remain in a, so children who are up for adoption are going to remain in a longer kind of, I won't call it unstable because I don't like that word. I think many things are unstable or unstable. But they're going to remain in a limbo, and either with one family kind of more permanently nor the other. So this is actually a good contemporary example of where the state is not seeing, you know, the consequences of what they think is a good solution or a good way of resolving adoption, let's say, and the adoption backlog.
Yes.
So your question was, and it has... It's different responses to different issues.
Exactly. It's quite complex and it needs a multifaceted approach.
But the most important thing is we stop giving out about the individual mother or the individual child or the individual drug taker, because these things are not individualized. They're societal and they're structural. And they go with a long history, which we all know about.
Yes.
But most importantly, they go with a kind of a contemporary story of an under-resourcing of families.
Yeah.
And family support services.
Indeed. Dr. Eleanor Moore, we thank you so much for your insights, and
we
appreciate the fact that you decided to stay up and drive the 24-hour economy, and thank your students for us as well.
Yeah, will do.
Much appreciated.
Thank you very much.
Okay, that's Dr. Eleanor Moore, Associate Professor, Department of Sociology at University of Cape Town, and she's also a Director of the Families and Societies Research Unit at the Center for Social Science Research.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.